Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest tonight is award-winning journalist Doug J. Swanson, whose brand new book is called Blood Aces, The Wild Ride of Benny Binion, the Texas Gangster Who Created Vegas Poker. We'll be talking to Doug in a few minutes. We received an email at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com criticizing Richard. A few shows ago, we were discussing a James Grosjean column about trading off seats to a teammate. Our emailer wrote, Munch mentions getting ploppies off of a game so he and his team could make more money. He said the ploppies were taking money out of his pocket. I'm not a pro, and I strongly object to this sort of behavior. This is why the casino would not want Richard playing there. Not only is he making money, he is preventing the casino from making money by shooing away the casino's best customers. I've seen some form of intimidation on the slot side, and it's just wrong. It's bad for the casino, bad for the average player, and in the long run, I think it is bad for the pro as well. How do you respond to that, Richard?
Well, first of all, I have to say I want the casino to make money. I want the casino to be successful because the more money the casino makes, the more money I can take out of that particular casino. So, you know, I want the civilians to play there. But often, in order for me to make money, I need, you know, the table to myself and my partners. Or even if it's just myself, the civilian players slow the game down, which means I earn a lot less than I would if they weren't there. So, you know, it's not that I want them to leave the casino. I just would prefer that they were not playing on my table. Now, I can understand that, you know, other people may not be happy about that, but, you know, think about, you know, if you're a waiter and you have a party of eight that comes in and spends 3 hours locking up one of your tables, you know, you're probably not going to be happy either, right? Time is money. You want them to get in, get out, you earn more. Now, you know, the restaurant patron would say, hey, you know, we want to stay here for 3 hours and enjoy our meal. I get it. You know, but like I said, I'm trying to earn a living. And so for me, I would prefer they play at a different table. And actually, some night we should probably have some pros on just to talk about some of the crazy things that we've done to get players off of the table, because some of those stories are pretty funny.
Yes, they are. That would be a good show. All right. The next question, this is going to go to you as well, Richard. On the website, richardmunchkin.com. A post recently recommended the blog called The Eye and the Grinder, although the exact reference is more complicated than that, so you're better off going directly to Munch's site. What's this blog all about, Richard?
This blog was started by a guy named T. Dane, who is a surveillance professional. He wrote a book a couple of years ago called Behind the Black Dome, An Advantage Player's Guide to Casino Surveillance, which I would recommend for players. It's much in the vein of Cellini's book or Vinnie DiCarlo, who we had on the show. And, you know, this is a guy who's a surveillance guy, but he is sympathetic to Advantage players. So he started a blog, and there's interesting stuff in there. Check it out.
He's writing almost every day, too. So he started only a few weeks ago, but there's like 8 or 10 or 15 different articles that he's written. Got a lot to get off his chest.
You know, a lot of bloggers start that way, and then after a while, it slows down. So,
yes, it does.
I'm happy to see it, but, you know, I wouldn't expect him to keep up that pace.
All right. Next weekend, there's a new, I guess we'll call it a semi-major casino opening in on the Strip, the SLS at Las Vegas Boulevard and Sahara. For video poker players, a large number of them will descend and at the opening and see if the casino has made any mistakes. With 1,000 or more machines and sometimes dozens of games on each machine, there's plenty of opportunity for a mistake to be made somewhere along the way. Also, now I don't know any of the people involved in the SLS team, but often the slot director at a new casino used to be the assistant slot director at his last job. And there's a lot of difference in knowledge between the two jobs. Although the assistant director doesn't understand the difference in knowledge until he gets bitten by it. And the same goes for the marketing department, who puts together the slot club and the promotions and that kind of thing. It would not surprise me at all if the place opens up too loose and you can't get your share of that unless you're there at the beginning, because when they discover it's too loose, they're going to tighten up. You can wait until others check it out and report back on the various websites after possibly some of the good stuff is gone, or you can brave the crowds and hope to find some of the opportunities for yourself. Now, much as I recall, you're not a big fan of going to grand openings. Is this correct?
Yeah, well, you know, like everything, there's an ebb and flow, and it used to be that advantage players flocked to casino openings for exactly the same reason. But, you know, now I've found that, you know, they often are just traps. You know, the casinos now know that everybody shows up on opening weekend, and so every you know, surveillance person is there on lookout, and, you know, often people from the, you know, things like it used to be the Griffin Agency or Biometrica, they would be there, you know, just waiting to see who was going to show up. So I personally stay away. I stay away from casino openings now, and, you know, I would give it at least a week to cool off before I went in.
All right. Let's talk to our guest. Doug Swanson is an investigative reporter for the Dallas Morning News. He has previously written crime novels, including Big Town, which was an Edgar Award nominee. He's been a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and twice has received award as the best reporter in Texas. Doug Swanson, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Hi, Bob. Hi, Richard.
All right. Now, this is about Benny Binion. Now, we know about him in Las Vegas, but the Benny Binion story started out in Dallas. So why don't you take 8 to 10 minutes, Doug, and tell us about the crime scene and Benny's involvement in it from like the mid-20s to the late 40s.
Well, let me back up just before that, because he was born in a little town in North Texas in 1904, and he got a second grade education, and then he hit the road with his dad. His dad was a horse trader. Benny had been very sick, had pneumonia several times, and his dad said, well, he's going to die anyway, I'm just going to take him with me. So Benny's dad, Lonnie Lee Binion, took this young boy out on the road with him, out across the great prairies of Texas, trading horses. And then later, Binion fell in with roving gamblers who would go from town to town with their dice games. And young Benny learned to be a steer man for those games. He'd go out and find the customer. He'd rove around town looking for the guy with the hunger in his eye. And that's where Benny learned dice as a very young man. That was his education, with these roving gamblers. Now, in the early 1920s, he came to Dallas. But he started out in Dallas as a bootlegger. This was during Prohibition. And he was a middleman. He figured out where the best moonshine was. He brought it into Dallas, and he sold it for distribution at the various speakeasies and back rooms and that sort of thing. And that's how he initially made his bones in Dallas. So it was during Prohibition, selling that liquor. Then he got into what was called the policy business, and that was basically a numbers game, a lottery business. His patrons were mostly black people in Dallas, but he was very successful at that. And one of the reasons he was successful was that he didn't tolerate any rivals. One of the first incidents was he was driving down the street with a friend of his, an associate. They saw one of his rivals doing business, so Binion and the associate jumped out of their car, ran over to the rival's car, and shot him dead on the spot. And that was a lesson to anyone who thought they might want to get in Benny's way in the policy business. About 1936, the city of Dallas, in effect, deregulated the gambling business, meaning the dice business in Dallas. And they did that because they had a big centennial celebration in Dallas, and they were losing people to Fort Worth, the city about 35 miles away, which had its own celebration. And in Fort Worth, they had an exhibit featuring topless cowgirls. So everybody was going over to Fort Worth. Dallas said, we need to get these people back, so what are we going to do? We're going to not enforce gambling laws. We're not going to enforce prostitution laws. So Benny moved in at that point and started what was called, what he called, the Southland Syndicate, and that was named for a hotel in downtown Dallas where he had one of his dice rooms. He had maybe a dozen dice rooms around town, and then he controlled all the others by demanding that they pay him a percentage of the handle. So he was the, by 1938, 1939, 1940, he was the top dice man in Dallas. He did that by, again, controlling his rivals and by owning the cops and owning the district attorney. He had friends all over town. He was the top guy. It was also a very violent time because these guys were like the drug gangs are now. They killed each other, but they killed a lot. And Benny had a running feud with a man named Herbert Noble, who also owned a dice den. And Noble didn't want to pay Binion 25% of his revenue. So this started a long feud, and there were multiple attempts to kill Herbert Noble. They tried shooting him. They tried to blow up his car. He was a pilot. They tried blowing up his airplane. He was known as Herbert the Cat Noble because he escaped so many times, these attempts on his life. He always blamed Binion for that. Binion never copped to it, but everyone believed Binion was the man behind that. At one point, Noble got so upset that he welded some bomb racks to the wing of his single-engine airplane. He had two napalm bombs. He had planned to fly over Binion's house and bomb the Binion family with these bombs, but the police stopped that. At another point, the professional hitmen in Dallas put a bomb under Noble's car, but Noble's wife came out and started the car, and it killed Noble's wife. So this went on for many, many years, and it was a very famous feud here in Dallas. Throughout it all, Binion kept his control. Then, in 1946, a new district attorney was elected, a new sheriff was elected, and they did not like Benny Binion. And so Benny Binion loaded up his Cadillac, allegedly with $1 million in the trunk. He had two of his associates, both carrying Thompson submachine guns, and they left Dallas and drove to Las Vegas.
Uh-huh. So Benny Binion is now in Vegas.
Yes.
And he's a bit of a gangster, big admirer of Bugsy Siegel.
Yes.
How did Binion end up owning the Horseshoe?
Well, he started out with the Las Vegas Club on Fremont Street. He was in business with a man named Kel Housels. I'm sure a lot of your listeners are familiar with him. Then he had another club called the Western Club, also on Fremont, very briefly. But in 1949, he and his son Jack bought what was left of the old El Dorado Club and turned that into the Horseshoe. And it was a success from the very first night.
Now, one of the things that I have always heard that one of the things he did, he was the first, you know, it's hard to separate fact from fiction. So I'm wondering if you were able to track some of this down. Like, I've heard that he was the first person to serve free drinks to the patrons. Is that true?
Well, I don't know if that's true. I mean, certainly that's the legend, and he did serve free drinks to patrons, and he sent the limo out to the airport to pick them up, and he gave away a lot of comps. His saying was, treat the little people like big people. That's the way he operated. Was he the first? I don't know. You raise an interesting point. There are an awful lot of stories about Benny Binion, and you can hear them all night long. I gave a speech in Dallas last night to about 250 people, and many of them knew the Binion family, said they were friends with Benny, and they were all telling these stories, but you try to run them down, and it becomes impossible. So in my book, I tried to stick with what I could verify one way or another. But someone like Benny Binion, there are 1,000 stories about Benny, and some of them are true.
Nobody knows the exact number of people Benny killed or contracted out to have killed. Right. He was never convicted of murder, but he did go to prison. How did that happen?
Well, let me address the first part of your question. He only acknowledged killing two people. One was the rival policy man that I mentioned earlier. The other was a rival bootlegger in Dallas. They were meeting in the backyard of one of Binion's houses in Dallas. It was not going well, this meeting, and the bootlegger allegedly pulled a knife. And, you know, the old saying about don't bring a knife to a gunfight. Well, Benny pulled a gun, shot the man in the throat, and killed him on the spot. And because of his quick draw capabilities, that's supposedly where he got the nickname the Cowboy. And by the way, he didn't serve any time for that killing or for the other. He walked away from both of them. That's the way things worked in those days. But to the rest of your question, the feds were after Binion for years and years, and this is one of the big surprises to me that I found in my research. The federal government was after Binion for his taxes. His rival, Herbert Noble, whom I had mentioned earlier, tipped the authorities to Binion's headquarters, where it was, his DICE headquarters, and the authorities raided it and found all his books and found that he was some years making more than $1 million off the dice game, but was reporting income of about $2,000. So the feds got very interested in this. But there was another reason they were interested. The Bureau of Internal Revenue, as it was then called in the early 1950s, had undergone a series of scandals, shakedown scandals, bribery scandals, things like that. It was a very dirty operation in the mind of the public. And so they wanted to straighten up their reputation. So the feds began this campaign against Binion, and it at one level was orchestrated by J. Edgar Hoover, the director of the FBI. And I think lots of people knew that because they knew the FBI chased Binion. But what I found and what surprised me was it wasn't just Hoover. It was the Attorney General of the United States at that time who held a series of meetings with his subordinates and with representatives of the FBI, planning how to get Benny Binion. And it didn't just stop there. It went all the way to the White House. President Harry Truman gave his attorney general and FBI director Hoover advice on how to pursue Benny Binion. They finally nailed him for taxes, and they sent him to Leavenworth in 1953 on a 5-year sentence.
And so he wasn't able to keep the horseshoe in his name, right? That's the horseshoe was kept in Jack's name, or Jack and Teddy?
No, it was nominally put in the name of a man named Joe W. Brown, who was a horse racer out of New Orleans. And that was the story at the time. But if you go back and look at some of the FBI documents that I saw, Joe Brown was just really a titular head. And what happened is a lot of the mob guys moved in at that point. Eddie Levinson was one of them, started taking over the horseshoe, kicking Benny's people out, running to themselves, skimming a whole bunch of money out of the place, and sending it off to the mob in Chicago, Detroit, Miami, New Jersey, out in there. It was a money factory for the mob while Benny was in prison.
And how did he take it back when he got out?
He had a ranch in Montana, which he mortgaged. He cobbled together some other money, and he got lucky. At that time, the feds were starting to take a hard look at skimming in Nevada, and I think some of the mobsters who were in control wanted to back off a little bit, get a little less high profile, so they allowed Benny to buy the horseshoe back.
Huh. And was he able then to put his name on the license?
No. You're right, that was in Jack's name, and Benny was listed as a public relations consultant, which, of course, was a ruse. That everybody knew that was a ruse. He ran the place. He sat at his table in the Horseshoe Restaurant. That was his office. People would come see him there, and then he ran it from there. He was always in charge. I mean, Jack was from the first, a very astute businessman, and he ran a lot of the business affairs. Teddy Jane, Benny's wife, helped a lot, too. She was back in the county room a lot and worked the cage. So it was a family affair. But you know, Benny Binion was running the place. There's no doubt about that.
There's reports that the police didn't come and bother the people at the Horseshoe very much because the Binions would take care of things from the inside. Is that true?
Oh, that's absolutely true. And I was when I was researching the book, I was talking with Oscar Goodman one day. In fact, it was his last day as mayor. I was there talking to him, and I asked him about that, and he said, you know, people didn't cheat at the Horseshoe. And, well, the fact is people did cheat at the Horseshoe, but what happened to them, if they were caught, is many of them were taken, I should say some of them, because I don't know what the percentage was, but some of them were taken out back to the security room, the security shack, and the security people had an umbrella stand in the in this room filled with canes that the people who used canes in the casino had lost or left behind. And they would put them in this umbrella stand. And when they needed to teach a lesson to someone, they would take out these canes and beat them. And I spoke to a man, Barry Finn, he's in the book, who was beaten very severely in this way. He's really one of the lucky ones because, as you may know, there was a young man, who was accused of cheating at the Horseshoe. He was being roughed up a bit and hustled out of the casino. He kicked in a plate glass window, broke it, and was running down Fremont Street in the very early hours of the morning, stumbled right in front of the Horseshoe. And three men came out of the Horseshoe. One of them was a security guard. One of them was a pit boss. One of them was Ted Binion, Benny Binion's son. And the pit boss took a gun, put it to the man's head, and shot him in the head and killed him right there on the sidewalk in front of the Horseshoe.
I was actually there the night that happened.
Really?
And the impression I had, I watched them throw the guy out, was that he was being drunk and obnoxious. I never heard anything that anyone had accused him of cheating. The story going around that night when it happened was that Ted was the one who pulled the trigger, but you know,
right,
the other guy ended up taking the rap for it.
Right.
Teddy came in and locked himself in the cashier's cage, and the police came and said, you know, Teddy, you got to come down to the station. There's a dead guy in the middle of the street. And
right,
he was like, F you, get out of my casino.
Right.
And the police broke down the door of the cashier's cage and, you know, took him out. And,
right,
you know, Benny's wife was there screaming at him, you know, you let go of my son. And, that was a pretty wild night.
As you may know, then, that the gun disappeared. It was never recovered. It was somehow taken away. There are still people you can talk to, and I talked to one of them who prosecuted this case, who believe that Ted Binion was the actual shooter and that the pit boss took the rap for him, and then money was spread around. I looked for this guy, the pit boss, for a year, trying to find him. Finally found him. He was down in Tampa, Florida. And he and I met in a little cafe in Tampa, and I asked him what happened, and he didn't want to talk unless I gave him some money, and I don't pay for interviews. So we didn't talk much, but to this day, he is still loyal to Benny Binion. Now, he was put on probation, but he never served any prison time for this. And also, let me back up a bit. That night, there were allegedly at least three witnesses who were going to say that Ted pulled the trigger. But when it came time to actually prosecute the case, the three witnesses flipped and said, no, it was the pit boss. And that's also what led to charges that there was some money spread around. I also talked to a man named John Koval, who was a taxi driver and a former New Jersey policeman, who claimed to have witnessed the shooting. And he said it was without a doubt the pit boss. The pit boss was a big guy. He played football at UNLV before he became a pit boss. So, you know, it's still a topic of mystery. You can find lots of stories, and it's really thrilling to me to talk to you since you were there.
Yeah, there's much more to that story. Some night I'll have to tell it on the air. But I also want to go back to you mentioning Barry Finn, who I believe Alan Brown was the guy with him.
Right.
You know, they were not cheats. They were advantage players.
Right.
They were playing, you know, perfectly legally, spotting the hole card.
Right.
That was the first very big casino settlement. You know, I was told that when they went to they went to the hospital after the beating.
They were beaten
so bad, and I was told that one of them received a phone call at the hospital from Teddy saying, "If you file a lawsuit, you'll be looking down the barrel of a 44." But they did file a lawsuit. They did get a big settlement, although the actual amount was, you know, I guess there was a non-disclosure as to the actual amount, but that was the first big lawsuit.
I can't remember what it was. $600,000, something like that. But you're right. And what Barry Finn told me was that you know, the criminal case was filed against Binion's grandson and some others, and when it came time to testify, Barry Finn said he got a phone call and was told, it would be best for you not to be too specific or bad things are going to happen. And so his memory got very fuzzy on the stand. But there was a conviction. A couple of them were convicted, including Binion's grandson. But the judge, Judge Foley, threw out the verdict.
So. That's how Nevada was back then.
It's an interesting place. You know, I have to admire... I mean, there are many things I admire about Benny Binion, and as I researched this book, and obviously he did some things that don't hold up to normal standards. He killed two people to begin with, but there were a lot of other things he was accused of doing. But Benny knew how to work every angle, and as I was going through some of these records, I got his prison file from Leavenworth. 300 pages. It took me about a year to find it. And going through there, and there's a letter from the chief probation officer, chief federal probation officer of Nevada, going on and on and on about what a great guy Benny Binion was and how he should be turned out of prison, that he should be set free. His family needs him. The community needs him. I mean, it was an impassioned letter, and it was very surprising that a federal bureaucrat would write this kind of letter. You just don't see that much. And as I dug a little further, I found out, well, this parole officer, chief parole officer for Nevada, had a second job, and his second job was, guess what? It was chief of security at the Horseshoe.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So that's the way
it
works.
The thing I find mind-boggling was... when they had this 80th birthday party for Benny at the Thomas and Mac,
right?
What year was that?
That was his 85th birthday. So I want to say, would that have been 83?
Okay, so
He died in 89.
Well, no, if he was born in 04, it'd been 89, right?
Well, he died in 89. So I would maybe, I don't know, I have to look it up. 86, 87, somewhere in there.
Anyway, I just found it mind-boggling that they, I mean, it was like the city was celebrating this guy as if he was, you know, just the greatest humanitarian they had ever seen, you know?
Right.
It was just, it was amazing to me how he changed his public persona so much from, you know, sort of thug, gangster, murderer to, you know, public servant.
Oh, exactly, and that's one of the themes of the book. I am contending, and I haven't been contradicted yet, that Binion's story arc, the arc of his life, is unmatched in American criminal justice history. This is a guy who went from basically a street criminal, street thug, to a racketeer, to a crime boss, to a very successful businessman, to a beloved civic figure, where, as you say, 18,000 people were chanting his name in this arena.
Yeah, and
there's,
singing
there's
happy
nobody
birthday.
Who has an arc like that.
Yeah, it's better.
And why
it's
is that?
A better turnaround than Joe Kennedy.
And I think there, you know, there's several reasons, and one is, I think that Binion figured out early on how to get the loyalty of people. I mean, he was a very, very engaging guy, right? I mean, people who loved him really loved him, and people who feared him, and often for good reasons. But he became a major philanthropist in Las Vegas, gave away tons of money. But he didn't just, it wasn't just that. He gave away money all the time to all sorts of people. If you were a busted up rodeo guy from Texas and you wandered through the Horseshoe, you know, Binion would buy you a steak and give you a roll of chips, or give you a handful of chips and maybe $100 and send you on your way. And people just loved him for that.
Now, there's two big poker stories in Binion's life. One was Johnny Moss versus Nick the Greek.
Right.
And the other was founding of the first World Series of poker.
Right.
So pick one of those and tell us about it.
Well, let me ask you a question.
Okay.
Because I have not been able to ascertain this. Do you believe the Johnny Moss Greek match ever really happened the way it's now described? I mean, now it's a part of great poker lore, this tremendous match of the gods at the poker table. But there are no pictures, right? The newspapers didn't mention it at the time. It didn't come up in the Greek's funeral. When Benny Binion sat down with an oral historian from the University of Nevada, Reno, and gave her 100 pages worth of material, he didn't mention Moss and the Greek. So did it happen?
Wow. Interesting question, yeah.
But the World Series of Poker, obviously, that, yeah, of course that happened, and it started in 1969 when Benny and son Jack went down to a so-called Texas gamblers reunion in Reno, and there was a casino operator down there who put together a poker game with a few of the all-stars. You know, Puggy Pearson was there, Sailor Roberts, Doyle Brunson, and it was just sort of a way to fill out the slow time of the season, maybe get a few people in the casino. They didn't do it a second year, but Benny and Jack saw it and thought, hey, this might be a pretty good idea. You know, it might be kind of a little publicity stunt. Let's get 5, 6, 7 players in the Horseshoe, and maybe some people will come in and watch them play, and maybe they'll lose some money at our tables while they're here. It started out very, very small in 1970, just a handful of players. I mean, the Horseshoe didn't even have a poker room. They had to move some tables out of the way and set up the poker table.
Yeah, there was a little alcove off the pit, and they would set up the poker tables there in the alcove. Yeah,
right. And it grew bigger, a little bit bigger every year, and got some more publicity, got some more players, got some more money, and you know, pretty soon, the wide world of sports is showing up. The CBS Sports Spectacular showing up. Amarillo Slim's going on the Tonight Show. Benny Binion's going on the Merv Griffin show, and it just grew from there and became this phenomenon. And I first saw it in the early 1980s. The newspaper I worked for sent me out to write a story about it. So that was my first experience. It was still at the Horseshoe then, and I'm not a poker player, but I was just entranced by this whole scene, all these guys playing cards.
The other thing that was so cool back then, you know, late 70s, early 80s, is when you would go look at, when they weren't playing the tournament events, they were playing cash games. And when you could stand, you know, just, I mean, 6 feet from the table, and right. these guys would be sitting around the table with just not only stacks of chips, but big stacks of cash.
Right,
you know,
right.
$30,000, $40,000, $50,000 in cash, and they, you know, throw them out there in the pot. And, yeah, it was fun to watch.
If you were, if you knew about poker at all, I mean, all your life you'd heard about people like Doyle Brunson, and then and all of a sudden there he is, as you say, 2 feet from you, playing for big money, and you could watch that, and it, that was a tremendous draw. And I think they figured out they had a good deal and worked it from there. Now the last time I was out in Vegas. Well, not the last time, but the time before that, I went out to the World Series of Poker, as is now held at the Rio, uh-huh. and obviously, this is a completely different atmosphere. Thousands of guys playing, hundreds of thousands of guys playing for big pots, but it's just not the same. I mean, the Horseshoe was that old, funky, smelly, smoky place where you could, as you say, stand very close to these guys, and yeah, the atmosphere is a lot different now.
Yeah, yep.
Was the Binion family useful to you in helping you gather information for this book?
Yes and no. Jack Binion and I talked a couple of times on the phone, once early in the process and once late in the process. And Jack was very cordial, but he did not want to cooperate for the book. He told me that there had been so much written about his father that he did not like, that he did not want to see it happen again, and he just didn't want to talk. I mean, as I said, he was very cordial. He was not, this was not an acrimonious discussion at all. Becky Bainin, excuse me, I had talked to her husband, and he told me she had absolutely no interest in cooperating with me. Brenda Binion Michael, Benny's daughter, who's now a rancher in Amarillo, was very nice and very cooperative to me. I went out and saw her, spent a lot of time with her. She's a wonderful, lovely lady, and she gave me all sorts of stuff and answered an endless rounds of questions. So she was extremely helpful and really helped me understand her dad. I think what she understands, as they all do, that there are some things in her father's past that are unseemly and unflattering. But I think what she hoped was that I would convey his more positive attributes, the doting father that he was, the horseman that he was, you know, he loved horses, the philanthropist that he was. So I tried to honor that in the book. I mean, I don't look away from the bad things he did, but I try to depict him as a whole person, as a whole character. I did a little Q&A for the New York Times that ran today, and I said in that that I was surprised when I finished how much I liked the man. I mean, there's no disguising that he did some bad things, but he's just a fascinating guy. That's a long way of answering your question, but two of the three surviving children did not want to talk to me for the book, but Brenda spent a lot of time with me. Then I was able to run down a lot of his friends, a lot of people who'd worked with him. There was a man here in Dallas who was alleged to have been Benny's favorite hitman back in the day. He was still alive in his 90s, and so I went out to see him, you know, now retired, and I guess hitmen have a good pension plan because he lived in a really nice house out in North Dallas with a big pool and all that. He's since passed on, but he was very nice about talking to me about Binion. He was one of the guys who made the trip with Benny when he left Dallas. He was one of the guys with a Thompson submachine gun who jumped in the Cadillac with Benny. This guy was so tough. Here's how tough this guy was. He only had one eye. Well, to begin with, he'd been a Marine in World War II in the Pacific Theater, and he was in some of the worst fighting in the Pacific. But then he came back here and got involved in the other business. And when I met him, he only had one eye. And what had happened was Herbert Noble, the Benyon rival, whom I mentioned earlier, had sent someone to kill this man, Mr. Matthews. And when Mr. Matthews was asleep, the man walked up to the bed and shot him in the head, shot him through the eye. The bullet exited at the temple. And Mr. Matthews got up, looked in the mirror, and saw he'd been shot in the head, and drove himself to the doctor. That's how tough he was.
Jesus.
Wow.
And I said, well, Mr. Matthews, what happened to the guy who shot you? And he said, oh, he got dead a little later.
He got dead.
That's all the detail he would give me.
Well, so you were able to get Benny's FBI file? Is that right?
Yeah, and that was both hard and easy. And the FBI, you know, the way you do it is you file a Freedom of Information Act request with the FBI, and sometimes it will take them years to process this. But fortunately, they had already processed what they had of Benny's file, so they sent me that right away. But it turned out it was only about half the file. The rest of the file, as far as I know, is the rest, was with what was called the House Select Committee on Assassinations, and that was a group that was assembled by the House of Representatives in the 1970s to investigate the assassinations of John F. Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and Martin Luther King. And as you may recall, when JFK was killed in Dallas, there was a lot of investigation into Jack Ruby's background, Jack Ruby being the bar owner who killed Lee Harvey Oswald. There was a lot of investigation into his background and his mob connections. And so that's why the FBI was looking into the Dallas mob of the 1960s. The rest of Benyon's file was in there. So it was in two parts, but I eventually put it all together. And I hope it's all of it. You know, God knows there may be some more of it floating around out there. I never did get all of Ted Benyon's file, Benny's son. That, according to the FBI, runs to about 12,000 pages. I only got about 500 of them before I had to finish writing the book. So, you know, who knows what's still in that file or when I'll get it. I should live so long. But one of the things that I found really interesting in Benny's file, beyond what I mentioned earlier with the White House being involved, is that in his later years, Benyon became a confidential informant for the FBI. They had listed him for years and years and years as a top hoodlum, but the local FBI special agent in charge eventually converted him to a confidential informant, and J. Edgar Hoover signed off on that, and Benny started feeding them information. I don't think it was good information, from what I could tell. I mean, I don't think it was especially vital information, but the idea that Benny Benyon, who'd been sent to Leavenworth by the FBI and the feds, would turn pigeon for the Bureau, to me, was quite stunning. And when I would try it out on his friends, they just wouldn't believe me. That Oscar Goodman said, that's a lie. I can't believe that. And there's another friend of his, a Texan named Billy Bob Barnett. I told him, and he said, you know, I no more believe that than if you told me there are Martians landing out there in the parking lot. They just wouldn't buy it. But it's there in the record. I mean, it's there in black and white.
Interesting. All right. We're talking to Doug Swanson. He's written this very interesting biography of Benny Benyon called Blood Aces. We're going to do a few commercials now, and then we have some more questions for Doug. The South Point has more than 10,000 games returning more than 99%. That's more than anybody else has. Every August, every Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday between 3 a.m. and 11 p.m., you can earn 200 points and spin the wheel in their $400,000 Swipe and Win giveaway. Prizes include up to $50 in free play, free breakfast buffet, and a booby prize of 2,500 points, which is worth $750. Of course, another booby prize you can get is a 2-for-1 buffet. For those of us who have plenty of food comps around town, this one is worthless. One of the possible prizes is called mystery gifts. This is basically a recycled giveaway item. It could be like an electric knife, could be a South Point jacket, could be something. You always have a choice of two or three items to choose between, and if you don't like your choice today, come back. As long as you come back before September 4th, you can redeem all of the prizes at that time. They're also giving away $600,000 this month to penny slot players. These are random awards that you collect at your machines. And this is in the form of free slot play. There are a number of must-hit-buy machines that are sometimes worth playing as the meters grow high enough. This promotion makes those games extra good to play because there's a good chance you'll collect some of the bonus money on your way to collecting the jackpot on the machine. According to one source in the casino, the bonus adds about 2% to the return of the game. We'll be starting up video poker classes beginning September 10th on Wednesdays at noon. First class will be Jacks or Better. We'll be talking more about them as we get closer. At the Palms, they have drawings every Friday night at 7 p.m. 10 winners share $10,000. You earn 5 times entries on Friday and Saturday, 8 p.m. to midnight, 2 times entries Sundays and Tuesdays. You do not have to be present at the drawing to win, but you need to claim your prize before midnight or you forfeit. Any player who enters the Friday drawing prior to 6:45 p.m. on Friday receives $10 in free play on Saturday. PFP, play for points, play for prizes, Monday through Friday. Tomorrow ends the 2 weeks where the gift cards from CVS may be obtained, up to $200 a day in gift cards. And for the last 2 weeks of the month, the main prizes are gift cards for Albertsons Markets. There is a $50,000 slot tournament next weekend that you can earn your way into. Between midnight this coming Monday, August 18th, through 10 a.m. Saturday, August 22nd, you need to earn 2,500 slot points or 40,000 video poker points to qualify. The tournament itself will begin noon, Saturday 22nd. First prize is $20,000. Prizes go 100 deep. VideoPoker.com remains the best place to practice a wide variety of games, including Quick Quads, Ultimate X, Extra Draw Frenzy Poker, Hyper Bonus, many others. Often these games are the best returning games in a casino, so if you want to practice them beforehand, this is a good place to do it. They have daily, weekly, and monthly contests. The weekly contest this week is 100 Play Quick Quads. This is a fun game, one of my personal favorites. As of today, the top 10 places all had an excess of 400,000 points for 100 hands. Practically speaking, the only way you can get that is to be dealt a royal, or if you're playing triple-double bonus, be dealt 4 aces and a kicker. So in addition to being fortunate to be dealt one of these spectacular hands, you need to score more than the other luck sacks. So, are you feeling lucky? On next week's show, we have a basketball bettor who's very, very successful at that. Munch, what do you know about this guy?
Well, many people know about this poker player, Vulgaris. Whenever he's on the late night poker shows, they introduce him as the most successful basketball bettor, in the world. Well, we have the second most successful basketball bettor. Vulgaris doesn't like to talk about it. Our guest does. I can't tell you his name right now because I don't know what name he wants to go by. It might be his real name. It might not. I haven't heard back from him about that. But anyway, so everything you always want to know about basketball betting with an edge next week.
All right. Let's go back to our guest, Doug Swanson, author of Blood Aces. Doug, this is your first nonfiction book. Your previous 5 books have been crime novels. They've been award-winning novels, actually. Your day job, being an investigative reporter, presumably falls under nonfiction. So going forward, do you think you'll concentrate on fiction or nonfiction?
I don't know. I had a great time doing this book. I really love the nonfiction format, so I hope I can do another. Of course, it depends whether the book sells or not. Today is its first day out. It was just released today, so we'll see how that goes. I wanted to say, you know, you mentioned South Point when you were doing your ads.
Yes.
And I had talked about Billy Bob Arnett earlier, the Texan who loved Benny. Billy Bob had a big honky-tonk in Fort Worth called Billy Bob's Texas.
Yes.
And he commissioned a big bronze statue of Benny Binion on horseback.
Yes.
To put outside the casino. Not the casino, the honky-tonk. And then Billy Bob went broke, like a lot of people in Texas did, and they moved, as I'm sure many of your listeners know, they moved the statue to downtown Las Vegas.
Yes, they did.
Where it stood for quite some time. And then in 2008, Michael Gunn moved it to South Point, and that's where it is now, of course.
Yes.
With Benny looking out over the casino floor. And there's a plaque there, at least there was last time I saw it, that identified Benny Binion as a founding father of Las Vegas. And I think that's what he was. That's one of the things I talk about in the book. And I think he, at least outside Las Vegas, has never gotten credit for that. I think, you know, people talk about Bugsy Siegel and some of the others, but Benny Binion was right there as modern Las Vegas was being formed and was a crucial part of that. So I think he's on the Mount Rushmore of Las Vegas as far as I'm concerned.
How the statue got to the South Point is actually an interesting story. One of the times when Michael Gunn was on this show, we spent about 10 or 15 minutes going through the story of how the statue got down to the South Point. So the archives can be found on bobdancer.com or richardmunchin.com. So that part's an interesting story.
As I recall, I think he told me he bought it for $1. I'd have to go back and check. But
that's what he said on the air. And
well, that's a good story.
So I'm not going to call Michael Gunn a liar.
me neither.
The Gunns were actually... Michael's father was Jackie Gunn, who passed away very recently, and the Gunns and the Binions were very close.
Yes.
Now, we have about a minute left. Were you able to contact Michael Gunn for this story? Or?
I did. I talked to him. He was great. We had a very lively interview. I loved talking to him. He's a very frank guy, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And was extremely forthcoming. Now, I was talking to him mostly about the statue, but we talked a little bit about Benny and Ted and all that, but I thought it was a great interview.
Yes, he's a good guy. I get a kick out of Michael Gunn. He's actually going to be on the show in the next few months talking about his father, Jackie Gunn, who
right.
was also a founding father of Las Vegas, although he did it in a considerably different way than Benny Binion did, I think.
I think so, too.
All right.
Without the murder.
Well, let me take this opportunity to say I'm going to be in Las Vegas on October 18th giving a speech at the Mob Museum.
Uh-huh.
So I would love for people to come out and tell me what they thought of the book or what they think of the book or whether they think I got it right or wrong. And I'm sure some people will tell me some things I don't know and didn't know. And that was my experience last night when I gave this speech. All these friends of Benny coming up and telling me things that I had known when I was doing the book. So that's Saturday, October 18th at the Mob Museum. I hope everyone will come out.
Well, you'll see me there. And if you drop me a note a couple weeks before, I'll make sure to get it on the air. So any of our listeners who remember this interview may want to come and visit. All right.
We are out of time.
Very good. Thank you, Doug. Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good night.
With your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.